Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, movement is underway in Raleigh on Charlotte's transit plan. Legislation is introduced to allow for a referendum on a 1 cent sales tax. Micro transit kicks off in North Mecklenburg and micro moves in the ongoing Riggs-Griffin race for the state Supreme Court. Facing what is described as a significant budget shortfall, Mecklenburg County residents are encouraged to help shape the budget. Hurricane relief money is approved by the General Assembly. CMS issues an apology. Madison Cawthorn is in trouble again. And legendary singer Roberta Flack dies. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE climate reporter Zachary Turner. Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Nick Oxner is chief investigative reporter for WBTV. And Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. Thank you all for being here. Good morning.
Morning.
So we have been waiting and waiting and waiting for Raleigh to begin considering our transit plan. And this week, that consideration began. Three Republican senators, Vicki Sawyer, David Craven, and Bill Rabin, introduced Senate Bill 145 on Monday morning. Mary, what would it do?
Yes, so this bill is essentially very similar to the draft bill that was approved by Charlotte, Mecklenburg County, and every town in the region but Matthews last year, and it would allow Mecklenburg County to put on the ballot a referendum to increase our county sales tax by a penny in order to pay for a number of transportation projects, including the Red Line.
In the Observer, Mary called this an inflection point for the plan and pointed out that the bill was introduced by three prominent Republican senators, two of whom chair the Senate Transportation Committee. Ryan, does that help its prospects of getting through the larger body?
A lot of people in the city and county would like to paint it that way, but as we see Nick shaking his head, I don't know that it does. There's just too big of a wall of Republicans and folks who really aren't fans of Charlotte who stand in its way. Pretty much just there's a lot of pettiness. Let's put it that way for a succinct description.
And you were clearly shaking your head, Nick. Why?
Look, there remains, I don't know. Unrealistic optimism in Charlotte that lawmakers in Raleigh are going to approve this tax increase, and we have to have the increase in order for, you know, these plans to go forward. Don't let the fact that a bill was introduced fool you into thinking it's going to go anywhere, because, you know, writ large, Republican lawmakers, well, really everyone in Raleigh, still thumbs their noses at Mecklenburg County. Whenever I'm in Raleigh meeting with sources, I still get asked, how's the great state of Mecklenburg, right? So we're the other to the folks walking the halls of the legislature. Plus, you know, you're going to convince Republicans to get on board with a tax increase or even paving the way for a tax increase, which they don't want to do. So there's two strikes just off the bat. And then finally, the point that my colleague David Hodges, who's done a lot of investigating of Charlotte transit system, would tell you is that there continue to be problems with the operation of CATS. And so Republicans are going to be loath to get on the bandwagon of giving them more money until the system as it currently exists is fixed.
So a lot of people in and out of the legislature have said this is going to be very tricky. In fact, one of the bill's sponsors, Vicki Sawyer, I think we talked about this last week, she represents Iredell in North Mecklenburg County, has commented that the bill is, quote, a long way from being palatable to have enough votes to even get to the floor, which underlines everything you just said, Nick. House Speaker Destin Hall and Senate Leader Phil Berger were in town this week to speak to the Charlotte Regional Business Alliance, and Hall emphasized there is a path forward for the bill, though he added it will not be easy. And Berger acknowledged that there had been improvements in our new plan, at least from the original one.
I'm encouraging my members to look at the proposal, to understand the reasons for it, and to make a decision. They'll have to make their individual decisions on what they're going to do.
Okay, so this is where I'm confused, because at the behest of legislative leaders, we modified our current plan, making it less train-centric and putting more emphasis on roads. 40% of the money will go toward roads, 40% to trains, and 20% to buses. But we have four plans on the table at the moment. So when legislators consider how they will vote on allowing us or not allowing us to have this tax to pay for it, are they also, Mary, considering one of those, all of those plans?
They are not, no. So that is a separate process, with planning process by the Metropolitan Transit Commission. They will be working on that process throughout the year. I did ask Ned Curran and Joe Bost with the Charlotte Regional Business Alliance earlier this week if they think the lack of specificity until later this year from the MTC could be a problem for the bill in the legislature. They said they don't think so, that they're going to be able to educate.
But why not? We'll talk. Wait a minute. Phil Berger comes to town. Tim Moore comes to town. And they say, your plan stinks, fix it. We fix it with four different plans. We send them a bill that they're considering to allow us to have a sales tax to fund one of those plans. How can they vote on whether or not to, if they didn't like the first bill, how can they vote on a tax if they don't know what's in the four bills or don't pick one of the four bills?
It's not going to be a bill. So the bill lays out how the money
plans
can be. The bill says,
okay,
40% cap on rail spending, everything else goes to roads and buses. That's what's in the legislation. That's what was approved last year.
Okay.
Separately from that process, the MTC is now considering how they would implement that funding breakdown. How much money would go to the red line, the silver line, the blue line, the gold line, better bus, micro transit, all of those various programs. So that is a completely separate process from the legislation. The legislation simply says you can spend X percentage of the money on rail, X percentage on buses, X percentage on roads, and here's how the money for roads will be divided between all of the municipalities in Mecklenburg.
So new House Speaker Destin Hall told members of the Charlotte Business Alliance that the transportation plan is, quote, heading in the right direction because both sides of the aisle, he says, and the business community had explained, quote, the need for investments and how you're really spending money to save money and create growth in the area. Do we need a transit plan to create growth? I'm not sure. Mecklenburg County Commission Chair Mark Jarrell was on this program on Tuesday. He sounded optimistic about the chances of passage after that meeting with the House and Senate leaders here in Charlotte and following a conversation that he says he had with Phil Berger and Destin Hall.
I think they understand that it's an economic engine. We did not drill down on specifics. It was more at a high level, but mm-hmm. they know that we're an economic engine. I think we heard some positive comments about the legislation that was filed yesterday with respect to transit. And I think the signal was it's going to be tough, but we feel like it is a win or a step forward.
How justified is he in that optimism?
I didn't actually hear optimism. I heard some words and I'll listen to all this. Well, the bill's improved. There's a way forward. All these things are great. Thanks for coming back and getting in the orbit of reality, but it's still not going to happen this year, right? It's a very tough way forward. I stand to be proven incorrect, but I would be shocked if a bill gets passed this year.
Well, that's interesting because as we've mentioned many times on this program and Malcolm Graham on City Council has said, we have no plan B. And yet the mayor told WCNC-TV a couple of weeks ago that we do have a plan B. It's called next year. We go back to the legislature next year. Again, Mark Jarrell.
Some folks are missing it, right? It's not really about 2025. It's about 2045,
right,
and 2055,
right,
that we really have to consider. And so I think we feel like we have a huge stake in this as it relates to being able to provide these mobility options.
And once again, I asked him that a question about the red line purchase that the city's already on the hook for and the skin in the game that we have and the all that stuff that we've talked about a thousand times. If the bill passes, as you say, it won't be soon. House Speaker Destin Hall says, quote, it will be well litigated through the General Assembly among various committees. That sounds like it's going to get bogged down. So two questions. What does well litigated mean? Does it also mean they might substantially change some things about this and then pass it? If it takes most of the session, will there be time to put it on the November ballot? And even if they pass it too late, will they put it on next November's ballot, or do they have to start all over again?
I think if this were ever to come to fruition, it'd probably look different. You're probably looking at a PCS, which is acronym for when they take a bill and totally rewrite it to say something totally different. I could see its maybe greatest chances as being part of a bill that does something else unpalatable. But you know, you're going to support this because it's giving this thing that we don't want to do. I do not share Commissioner Durrell's optimism on their chances here.
So Phil Berger told the Charlotte Regional Business Alliance that he is encouraging senators to look at the proposal and understand its purpose. But is that purpose truly clear, even among people here in Charlotte? I mean, is the goal here just to increase transit options and improve the system we have? Is it to reduce congestion? Is it to encourage development? How are we positioning it to legislators?
The bill itself starts off with an intro that goes in depth about congestion, and they're painting it as in the bill itself as a big congestion reliever. But I think obviously that's just a little piece of it. It has to do with development. You saw Charlotte City Council focused on transit-oriented development on Monday as a huge presentation that was sort of almost like a nod to why this is important, even though it was never really mentioned in connection to it. All the different corridors that have sprung up as walkable communities that were nothing before the Blue Line. And I think that presentation was really sort of a look at this and look what we do when we build a light or rail in general, transit rail.
Yeah, the city's interim planning director, Monica Holmes, reminded council at that meeting on Monday that one goal for the Charlotte 2040 comprehensive plan is to, quote, promote moderate to high intensity compact mixed use urban development along high performance transit lines and near separated shared use paths or trails, word salad. So, but the 2040 plan is separate from the transit plan. And it seems to me that these two plans need to agree with each other. Can they, given the changes that we've already made, Ryan?
Oh, I mean, I think that's almost like everything has to work together, right? So anytime that you're making development plans, you want, you know, there are certain areas that people want to get developed more. The people in DeRida are very invested in this red line because they're sort of just left out there in North Charlotte and don't have the same, people don't have the same access to them, and they want an upgrade to their, you know, red brick downtown that I love. But, you know, it's just something along those lines where one thing has to go hand in hand with the other once they're both approved. Everything affects the other, the next thing.
And although when he was here on Monday, House Speaker Destin Hall stressed that most of the membership of the House understands, this is a quote, that it's important to invest in infrastructure, Town of Matthews is not happy that the Silver Line will not be coming to that area, and they're taking what Mayor John Higdon calls a strong stand against the proposal. A Republican House member, Tricia Cotham, represents that area. I have 20 seconds, Mary. Is she on board, or will she take Matthews' side in this?
She appears to be on board. Senator Vicky Sawyer said at a legislative briefing earlier this year that she, along with Democratic State Rep Becky Carney, will be taking point on the bill in the House.
Okay. Something did happen. Something brand new happened this week with regard to transit, and we'll talk about that when we come back and get an update on the never-ending Riggs-Griffin race. Stay with us at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Zach Turner's with us. He's our climate reporter at WFAE News. Nick Oxner's the chief investigative reporter at WBTV. Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. So, with or without the transit plan, something new began this week. CATS debuted micro transit in northern Mecklenburg County. It's been described as being similar to Uber or Lyft. So, Mary, what is it and how does it work?
Yes, yeah, so it is indeed, as someone who gave it a test run this week, very similar to Uber and Lyft. The idea from a public transit side of things is that rather than having to go to a bus stop or a train station, you can simply hail a ride. In the case of CAT service, it's a minivan, and it will come to you wherever you are, your home, a park and ride, a local business, and take you to where you want to go.
Well, Zach, it's not wherever you are. It's only in a certain part of the county. What is the operational jurisdiction of this?
That's true. It kind of operates within this amorphous zone that follows I-77. It goes from up in Davidson down to North Lake Mall, a little bit past Huntersville. And it stretches into the downtowns of Huntersville and Cornelius along the way. But it doesn't go all the way out into the suburbs. But it stretches between some of these main like focal points of transit.
Mary.
Yeah, and it's a pilot program for now. CATS has said they have 19 other zones throughout the county pinpointed that they would eventually like to expand into if this pilot program goes well and if they can get some additional funding from that transit bill.
Bruce Jones is service planning manager at CATS.
So if it's picking them up directly from their neighborhood and then taking them directly to their doctor's office, to grocery stores, it provides them that direct connection.
So you've already ridden this, Mary, as I understand it. You took advantage of this to check it out. When you use the app, and I think that's how you summon them,
yes,
do they then take you to precisely where you want to go, or do they take you to the nearest bus stop so that you can connect to where you want to go?
They take you exactly where you want to go. So I don't live in the zone. So to test it out, I parked at the park and ride in Huntersville, took it to downtown Davidson and back. And I picked a bookstore because I like bookstores, and got dropped off right in front. And when it was time to go back, I got picked up right in front.
Brett Baldeck is the communications manager for CATS. He says among those showing interest in this newly launched service are Davidson students, but there are also limitations when you go shopping to use this on how much you can bring with you.
It's really been a sea of different types of people, all for different things. They want to maybe go shopping or maybe go to healthcare or maybe go to a community rec center. And that's kind of what the goal was when we first launched microtransit.
So Uber and Lyft kind of put a big dent in the taxi cab business. This is likely to put some dents in the Uber and Lyft business. What is the cost of this service?
It is $2.20 one way for an adult, a little bit cheaper for kids.
Wow.
I will say, too, looking at Gastonia's service, that Uber's actually a part of that. They have this part of their application called Uber Transit, and that's mm-hmm. what Gastonia uses in order to navigate and go to, get from point to point.
Ryan.
This is actually an interesting sort of competition that's starting, well, not even competition yet, but there are private services in NoDa, Plaza Midwood. I believe it's Jump Transit in NoDa, Bont or Jaunt in Plaza Midwood. You're going to start seeing these pop up all over the place, probably before CATS even rolls out, or whatever CATS becomes rolls out with their new zones. And so it'll be interesting to see just how popular this becomes, or if there's a bubble or a trend, or how it works.
Well,
it's looking pretty popular, NoDa.
And this is a trial or a pilot program to see how it works and whether people will use it. And I suppose whether or not it is cost effective, because at $2.20 a trip, will it be cost effective if it's not constantly being used by multiple passengers? Because this is, as I understand it, a ride share. You could be in that car with other people going other places, correct?
Yeah, right. So the idea is that if two people order along a similar route at about the same time, you might end up sharing a car with someone else. doesn't necessarily mean that's going to happen for every ride, but that is an option. But the cost effectiveness is definitely one of the criticisms that you hear from transit advocates that are not necessarily completely on board with microtransit, that it's a good idea in theory, but that it's more of a bridge to help people who don't live in neighborhoods that have bus or rail readily available to still have some access to public transit, but that it's not necessarily an effective wide strategy because, like you said, it's not necessarily the most cost-effective form of transit since it's not moving as many people in one direction as a bus or a train.
And they do caution that if you're bringing a child who requires a car seat, you have to bring the car seat with you, Zach.
There are a couple of restrictions like that. You have to bring your car seat. You can't be bringing a lot of like luggage or groceries with you. That's going to take up an additional seat because, after all, you're supposed to be sharing that space with another person if they hop on, as it's a public ride share. Speaking of the cost effectiveness on it, that was something when I was speaking to Gastonia's transportation director, Randy Gates. She said that was never really something that they were shooting for with their program in Gastonia. They knew it was going to be a comparable price on the offset to, you know, what they were paying for buses at the bus service. And it became even less so as they were expanding the program since it was so rapidly adopted. But they said to them the trade-off was worth it because their ridership was way up.
So years ago on this program, we spent years talking about HB2. We even had a tip jar for every time that we had to mention it. We put money in the tip jar. We've shifted that the label on
the cars are coming flooding back, Mike.
That's right. The tip jar label's been changed to Riggs Griffin, the Riggs Griffin race. This is the last undecided race in the country lingering from the November election, and it pits, as you recall, Democratic incumbent State Supreme Court Justice Allison Riggs against challenger Judge Jefferson Griffin, who sits on the Court of Appeals for a seat on the Supreme Court. After multiple bipartisan recounts, Riggs remains ahead by 734 votes, which is more than the margin of victory that resulted in Chief Justice Paul Newby's defeating of his opponent. Griffin wants 65,000 votes tossed, and he and fellow Republicans were perfectly fine with those votes until, of course, they lost. It's being shuttled like a badminton birdie between federal and state courts. It's now in the State Court of Appeals. Initial briefs have been heard. Final briefs will be heard on March the 3rd. Then there will be a hearing. Because it is in the State Court of Appeals, some say it favors Griffin. Why, Nick?
Well, because Republicans hold a handy majority on just the overall makeup of the Court of Appeals. Of course, this will be a three-judge panel picked by the chief judge, Republican Chris Dillon, that will hear this case, even though Justice Riggs has asked that the full Court of Appeals hear it in a procedure known as the court sitting en banc. That's probably not going to happen. And then, you know, Republicans also hold a majority on the state Supreme Court, which is why this race is, you know, why Democrats view this race as so pivotal, because they view it as the way to take back the majority on the court. That being said, we've actually seen doubt cast on the theory behind Judge Griffin's legal challenge cast by Republicans. ProPublica had a good story a month or 6 weeks ago about the internal skepticism of this strategy and legal theory from Republicans. I believe it was Judge Dillon, the chief judge on the Court of Appeals himself, who wrote a previous opinion on this case that also cast stinging doubt on this. So I would not be among those people who think that it's a lock for Judge Griffin.
And there's a lot of stuff going on. It's inevitably going to go to the state Supreme Court, no matter what the Fourth Circuit decides. And Justice Allison Riggs sits on the state Supreme Court. She has said that she will recuse herself from this. I'm curious about why she's on the court, because her term expired. She ran for re-election. She won. That win is in dispute, but she's still sitting on the court.
I'm also curious about that.
Okay. So there's that. She says she will recuse herself if it goes to the full court. He sits on the State Court of Appeals, and he said he will recuse himself from hearing that. But she, as you said, wants, I think, an en banc hearing without two of the other Republicans. She wants two GOP judges removed from considering the case. Ryan, why?
Well, the one that's getting the most attention is Tom Murray, who's a judge who donated $5,000 to Griffin's Legal Defense Fund last year. That seems the most obvious call out. There's another judge, Valerie Zachary, who I know NC Democratic Chair Anderson Clayton has called out to recuse herself. There's not such strong calls for that because it's not as big of a conflict of interest. They hosted a party together in some way that Zachary had to repay Jefferson Griffin's campaign for. It wasn't a contribution, it wasn't a donation. So it'll be interesting to see what the Tom Murray thing is, but I don't think anything's coming on the Judge Zachary front.
So if Riggs is successful in getting two other Republican judges removed, what would that do to the political balance of the appeals court?
Well, it's unlikely, as Nick pointed out, that they're going to rule as a full body. So it's right. Just going to affect who is selected on a three-judge panel. I don't put anything past anybody, but there's not a great chance Tom Murray will be selected anyway because the questions that have been raised. But you know, who knows at this point? We're 110 days in, and things just keep twisting and turning.
We have discovered that at the United States Supreme Court, there are no ethics rules, evidently, that seem to govern any of them doing anything. Are there any at the state Supreme Court level? Because it seems to me that if you are a judge hearing a case about who wins this election, and you've made a $5,000 contribution to one of the plaintiff's campaign, that you would have to recuse yourself automatically. You'd do it yourself. You wouldn't have to be asked.
You know, the legal profession continues to be a self-regulating profession when it chooses to self-regulate. And that, I think, I think that that's what we have here. We should also say this is what happens when you make races partisan, which we did about a decade ago in North Carolina, right? And so just naturally, when you're forcing these nonpartisan beings, and way back before I had enough sense to know I don't want to do this, I ran statewide judicial campaigns for people running for Supreme Court and Court of Appeals. They were not political beings at the time. They did not like it, but you have to be forced to be if you want to get elected and be a judge. And so, you know, we should not ascribe super sinister motives to all of them all of the time for operating within the system that they're forced to be able to do their jobs.
Okay, well, we'll be talking about this for the next several months, so stay tuned. Because county commissioners wanted to go easy last year on a property tax increase, the chickens are now coming home to roost, and hopefully they don't have the bird flu. County leaders say that we are facing a significant budget shortfall. They are expecting $49.2 million in revenue next year, but they already need an additional $61.9 million. But when Commissioner Mark Jarrell was on this program this week, he reminded us that the downturn in commercial real estate is the prickly part of this. And he reminded us that because there are fewer tax revenues coming in from commercial properties, the weight was shifted to residential properties. So it appears that a property tax increase is almost certain. Has anyone said how much, Mary?
We haven't been told a specific number yet. Going into last year's property tax season, we did have a specific number only because it was sort of predetermined by the school bonds that had been approved on the ballot. This year, we haven't heard a specific number, but it definitely seems likely. And again, it's all rooted in last year's budget cycle. The way the budget was initially rolled out for the county, there was going to be an additional tax increase on top of the school bond related increase that was cut because commissioners said they wanted to sort of spread out the increases. They thought that would make things a little bit easier on property owners. But again, as you said, now they're facing this shortfall and having to debate how much to increase taxes versus how low can they deplete their sort of rainy day fund in order to cover these shortfalls, especially when you consider CMS's increasing needs, which is a huge portion of the county budget.
Well, they called it a significant shortfall. And if you just do the math on the revenues, they need $61.9 million and they have $49.2 million. That leaves a deficit of $12.7. That doesn't sound significant when you talk about the amount of money this county brings in and spends. Is it?
Oh, I'm sorry.
It is when we're talking about tax dollars, right? I mean, yes, you're right. As a percentage, it's not huge, but it's got to come from somewhere. And guess where government spending comes from? Your wallet.
Yes. And my wallet. So Mark Jarrell, when he was on the program, said that the county will have to tighten its belt. So I asked him what that would mean for residents. How will they feel it? What services might they miss?
Critical services are always going to be met. That's going to be our number one goal. We're going to make sure critical services, service delivery for our residents are met. But those other initiatives that we've had, we'll have to take a look at those and probably not fund those, at be able to fund those at the levels that they've been funded over the last five fiscal years.
He called those the county's passion projects, among them economic development projects. If you need more money, should you be cutting economic development projects?
It's quite the chicken and egg question now, isn't it?
Right, because as you mentioned earlier, Mike, in our transit conversation, that you don't need transit necessarily to spark growth in Charlotte-Mecklenburg. It's going to happen regardless, and it's coming every day. So you need to be able to fund services and things that are going to cater to that growth, because it's not going to stop one way or another.
So Mecklenburg County is conducting an online survey. They are encouraging residents to participate in this survey and to express their priorities and opinions on what the budget should fund. Your opportunity, Mary, to do that, I believe, ends today. So how do people access this survey?
Yes. So my understanding is that people can access it through the county website. They can also, there's already been a county budget public hearing, I believe. I could be wrong. There's another on the calendar between now and when the first proposed budget will roll out in early May. So opportunities there for people to talk about what they're passionate about, libraries, schools, parks, anything like that, that they want commissioners to prioritize in the budget process.
The city has said they are not planning to raise property taxes, but if the county does so, it may come at a time when voters are going to the polls and being asked to decide whether they want to put 1 cent sales tax on everything they buy to support the transit plan. Could the prospect of a county tax property increase, could that impede the yes votes? I have 10 seconds. Mary.
Potentially. It's not good news. I can't say that it's bad news, but it's not good news.
So when we come back, we'll talk about a CMS apology that was released this week, funding for Hurricane Helene recovery, and more. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. We're here with Zachary Turner, a climate reporter for WFAE News, Mary Ramsey, local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer, Ryan Pitkin, co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve, and Nick Oxner, chief investigative reporter for WBTV. Last week, there were anonymous threats made to five CMS schools, and this week, CMS Superintendent Dr. Crystal Hill made an online video apology to parents.
Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools is committed to addressing the confusion, frustration, and delay, and we acknowledge that clear, consistent communication is essential to restoring and maintaining trust.
So, Nick, what did they do wrong that the superintendent found it necessary to apologize for?
Well, they failed to alert the school communities and parents and students to these threats initially, and there was a lot of feeling by these school communities that they were, left in the dark or not properly informed about these real serious risks.
And the alleged perpetrator was the 31-year-old Drew Owens. He was arrested following the incident. He threatened in those emails to shoot up and kill all blacks at several schools. He is black. Ryan, how did they track him down, and where is he now?
Yeah, I'm not sure the exact details of how they tracked him down, but it looks like it probably wasn't all that difficult in the sense that he had two parents working in one of the schools that he threatened, and he's been sort of known to have drug and mental health issues, and it's believed to be a result of him being kicked out of his home for those issues that he is now threatening his parents. He is still in custody as of the last time I saw. Correct me if I'm wrong, Nick. I know you've done reporting on this, but
his bond was increased yesterday.
Yeah, his bond was increased. He's still there. And I'm assuming that, those leads, I mean, I don't know. I can't speak to the investigation, but that's how he was tracked down.
Okay. So it took a while, but this week, State House unanimously approved more funding for Hurricane Helene recovery efforts in the western part of the state. How much money, Nick, did they approve?
$500 million, $500 million in this round of funding.
And this money is to be used to rebuild homes, clean up debris, and rebuild private roads and bridges. $500 million sounds like a lot of money, but Democrats, who all voted in favor, are they're concerned that it will not be enough. Representative Dudley Green of Avery County spoke about the importance of this funding.
This brings the relief funding this body has allocated to well over $1 billion. And for that, our region thanks you. We all hope that that money will start flowing soon. But I fully expect that this won't be the last that will be needed in this or future sessions.
So are there plans to revisit funding before this session ends?
Yeah, so just remember, we're at the very start of what's called the long session. In odd-numbered years, we're in the long session, even-numbered, we're in the short session. And the long session will stretch till at least July, maybe August, September, who knows. And when I interviewed Speaker Destin Hall in late January, he anticipated or forecast passing a bill through the House with additional funding in February. So he's about, we're at the end of February, it's probably about a week or so behind where he had predicted at that time. I think it's important to note, Governor Josh Stein, a Democrat, but who has been working with Republicans on hurricane recovery, and everyone seems to be getting along so far on this front across party lines, has called for $1 billion of hurricane funding. This is half that, obviously, but I think the difference would be lawmakers seem to be taking a let's wait and address the funding needs in tranches instead of passing one bill all at once.
Yeah, Josh Stein had asked for a bill that would include $150 million for grants to businesses that experienced losses in the storm, $100 million to local governments to replace lost revenue, $34 million for affected schools to let them offer a summer learning program to make up for lost days that were lost because of the storm, and $10 million for housing services aimed at people experiencing homelessness because of Hurricane Helene. Will any of these items were they addressed in this bill? Will they be addressed in later bills?
All these priorities are priorities that everyone agrees needs to be looked at. In fact, I think the biggest agreement, other than private roads and bridges and the need to fund that because the federal government won't, is actually the need for small business grants, because that's another gap in what the federal government won't do. And so I think the lawmakers, the Republican lawmakers, would tell you that's actually the reason to go slow in appropriating, because again, Speaker Hall told me they want to look and see where the federal dollars aren't flowing that are needed and come in with state dollars to make up those gaps.
And this still has to go to the Senate. Do we have any idea what they are thinking?
No, but I would be shocked if this doesn't get passed more or less the same.
Attention DMV sufferers. Wayne Goodwin has announced he is stepping down as head of the North Carolina Division of Motor Vehicles. He has been a frequent target of Republican criticism for how the DMV is managed. But why did he choose this moment to announce his intention to leave that job?
Mostly because the Stein administration advertised that it was taking applications for his replacement. His announcement that he would step down came after he said he intended to try to keep his job. It's worth noting, Mike, that Wayne Goodwin took over an agency that was already well under scrutiny and siege for its myriad problems and delays. He has done a lot to try to address those, and he's been markedly more transparent and accessible than his predecessor. It's a low bar. But those problems and delays persist, and it really makes you wonder, you know, do we need to just start over? We can't do that, but start over at the North Carolina DMV.
You could. You just call Elon. He'll start it over for you. You just call Elon. A couple of weeks ago, we had the Central Intercollegiate Athletic Association's Commissioner Jackie McWilliams Parker on the program. She was coy then about whether or not Charlotte had a shot to bring back the CIAA tournament, which moved after years here to Baltimore a couple of years ago. The city has decided to put in a bid to have them return. And Mary, you report that there may be a roadmap to successfully luring them back. What do they want?
Yes. So the Observer obtained through a public records request the league's request for proposals, which is basically just the document they send out to all the potential host cities that says, here's what you have to do, and here are some ideas for how to sweeten your bid. One of the big points of emphasis in the request is hotel space. That was a big point of contention in Charlotte back when the tournament left in 2020. The RFP lays out very specifically how much the league wants teams to be charged that are coming to play in the tournament for their rooms, the kind of deals they want arranged for fans coming to town for the tournament. It's also a point of emphasis in a presentation from the Charlotte Regional Visitors Authority, which is involved in the bid that they sent to some city council members. They emphasized the need to get a hotel package in order, as well as event space at the Spectrum Center, Bojangles Coliseum, and the Convention Center. They also floated the idea of raising about $1.5 million for a scholarship fund to help sweeten the bid.
Do we know how Charlotte's bid matches up to those requirements?
We have not seen the bid yet. So far, their city leaders are being pretty coy. They don't want to tip their hand, was the exact quote from Malcolm Graham on what they're bidding. But that presentation from the CRVA mentioned getting those hotels and venues in order, a scholarship fund, and the potential of looking into other enhancements like putting together a career fair, concerts, and other events related.
When they left, one of the reasons they left is they felt they were being not treated well by restaurants and by hotels. They were being overcharged, etc. And it also seemed that the city was okay that they were leaving because there had been some disturbances in the streets, not really directly connected to the tournament, but there were, you could make a loose connection to it. So why do we want them back?
One is the money. This was a big economic driver, brought in a lot of money annually for a long time here in Charlotte. There's also a cultural significance. The vast majority of schools in the league are in North and South Carolina, huge alumni bases in Charlotte. This was a big reunion weekend, and you see right at the forefront, council members Malcolm Graham and James Mitchell, who are both proud HBCU alums, really leading the charge and talking about how this was a really important event for the Black community in Charlotte especially, and it would mean a lot to have it come back. And you've also got the added thing that the league is still headquartered here in Charlotte. So there's a logic to it, in a sense, having that connection.
Nick, you reported this week that a convicted felon was hired by the Mecklenburg County Department of Social Services while still on active federal supervised release. What was he convicted of, and into what county department was he hired?
Yeah, he was hired as a child welfare specialist with Mecklenburg County DSS's Office of Youth and Family Services. He was convicted as part of a federal takedown of a 30-person drug ring dealing PCP in New York and Connecticut. He was sentenced to more than a decade in prison. He served 8 years in prison, was sentenced then to 10 years of supervised release. That supervised release, he tried to get cut short, and a judge denied that request, citing his history as a, quote, career criminal. And then he ended up being hired as a social worker in DSS.
And here's what Mecklenburg County Manager Dina DiOrio told you when you spoke with her just prior to a meeting.
Well, I think we gave you a statement, and we've explained in the statement what our position is on that, so I don't really have anything else to add. It's an HR issue, so I'm not going to get into the details, but we gave you a statement, and I really can't give you any more information than that.
But I'm actually asking about the process of why the county isn't conducting background checks on people that are interacting with children. Why won't the county answer basic questions about children's safety?
I think in our statement, we did say that we follow state and federal laws, which includes background checks.
But is that the case? And I ask because Gaston State Representative Donnie Loftus recently spoke about a draft of a bill that would require a background check for any county, city, or school employee who interacts with children.
When I shared what I was working on with some of my colleagues, it was unbelievable. Their response was like, you got to be kidding me. There's nothing out there to protect innocent children.
So Dina DiOrio believes that the county followed state and federal law requiring background checks. Representative Loftus says that requirement doesn't exist. So help me out here, Nick.
There is no requirement. They can be technically true that they followed state and federal law because there is no requirement that a background check is conducted. And I found that out in the course of my reporting. I called Representative Loftus and who kind of champions DSS issues in the House, who showed up at our interview with this draft bill, which was the fastest response I've ever gotten to us to an investigation. But yes, it stunned me that there is no requirement in North Carolina for a background check for a DSS employee.
What's that hiree's status now?
Oh, he was suspended and then allowed to resign late last year. The provenance of that would be discerned if other public agencies would produce records that they're required to make.
So for years, Tiga K has had a deer problem. That's D-E-E-R, by the way. About 1,000 of them roaming around, and they've tried various different tactics to reduce the population. The latest was hiring sharpshooters to hunt them, and they've been successful. And Zach, you report that it has been so successful that it's benefited another community. Fill us in quickly.
It was a banner year for TKK and getting rid of some of their deer. They did some deer sterilizations, got about 200 of them, 80 deer from culling in December. And that meat from that venison went to the Catawba Nation, where they distributed it for free to households there. And an effort to promote food sovereignty and connect people back to traditional native foods.
And Courtney Knight is the food stewardship program manager for the Catawba Nation, and they partner with Country Carrot. That's a local food hub and market to help homebound seniors, among others. The venison resulting from the culling of the Tiga K herd has really come in handy.
Country Carrot, who is one of our local food hubs, who helps us do our homebound program. So we have homebound seniors who can't obviously get out of their house, and so they deliver to them from the market. But they were actually on the verge of closing their doors down before we came along with this program, and now they have actually moved into a bigger building.
So there were a lot of deer, and they've been dealing with this for years. Does this end the Tiga K deer invasion?
No, I mean, it's all part of the wildlife. And I should clarify there, when she was talking about Country Carrot, she was talking about the larger partnership with the Food Distribution Center and the grant that they have to get local food, not just deer meat, but local food from Catawba farmers. I saw Ashe County cheese there. But the venison, you know, I think as long as TGK is going to be culling deer and as long as Catawba Nation will pay the processing fee, they'll have a steady stream of venison.
My. There's a silver lining to even the worst of problems, I suppose.
The first time ever I saw your face, I thought the sun.
Voice of Roberta Flack, a North Carolina native born in Black Mountain who went from being a music teacher at an African-American high school in Farmville to one of the most successful singers of the 1970s and 80s. In 2009, Roberta Flack was inducted into the North Carolina Music Hall of Fame, where she was celebrated for her musical achievements and her dedication to elevating the state's musical legacy on the world stage.
Strolling in the park, watching winter turn to spring. Walking in the dark, seeing lovers do their thing.
In In 1999, she was honored with a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, and in 2020 received a Lifetime Achievement Award at the 63rd Annual Grammy Awards. Roberta Flack died Monday at the age of 88. That's the time I feel like making dreams come true. And that's all the time we have. Thanks, Zachary Turner, climate reporter for WFAE News, Mary Ramsey, local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer, Nick Oxner with WBTV, and Ryan Pitkin with Queen City Nerve. Thank you all for the hour. When you're
touching me. Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.